I'm Christopher Lydon with Dan Chasen, a poet of self and nature, a sort of space-age Thoreau who brings the eyes of boyhood and the eyes of an orbiting satellite to what John Ashbery calls his unassumingly encompassing gaze. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one, in our series, Whose Words These Are, is sampling the practice of poetry in our time. Dan Chasen is both a maker and a sort of watchman on the art. He teaches at Wellesley College. He reviews poetry for the New Yorker magazine. His third book of his own verse from Knopf is titled Where's the Moon? There's the Moon. Dan Chasen, thank you for joining us. Would you leap in with a signature poem or two or five out of the new book?
Sure. Thanks, Chris. This is called Mosaic of a Hair, Corinium 100 AD. And I'll read through it and then say some things about it.
Hair spelled H-A-R-E.
The hair is spelled H-A-R-E. Yes, that's something I always feel that I have to clarify. It loses in gravity if you imagine the word spelt the other way, I think. Mosaic of a Hair, Corinium 100 AD. The boats pulling in, the boats pulling out. The top hat commerce of the infant century. Crowds. The certainty of others, the bomb that filled the air with horsehair, and the ambulance after. Why wouldn't I hide in my little glass body? I have a clover sprig made of glass to aspire to with my glass appetite. I raise certain questions about art and its relation to stasis, yet I despise the formalists as naive and ahistorical. Here's my problem with America. This would-be that obliterates all other moods, playing over and over in people's heads, the abstract optative that destiny works out. I don't have the luxury to think in terms of destiny. What nobody seems to get about me is, though you're made of glass, it doesn't mean you don't have appetites. I do. Or fears. I do. The day the darkness took the whole basilica, I was afraid. And equally afraid the day, centuries later, they switched the lights on. Let rabbits think in terms of destiny. Whitman, the great American rabbit poet, the rabbits in the government, the rabbits that light, and the ones that snuff out the fuse, and all their pretty rabbit children waiting to be casserole.
What's this rabbit poet? Or is it Updike's rabbit, or Brer Rabbit, or Duke Ellington's Rabbit Hodges, or what?
All of those. Also, there's a wonderful Wallace Stevens poem called The Rabbit as King of Ghosts, one of my favorites. And I don't know. I mean, the origin of this poem is weird but straightforward, which is that I was sitting at home watching the History Channel, and I saw a documentary about the Wall Street bombing in 1920, and there was an image in it of a kind of ruined, decimated horse, a horse that was blown up by this bomb. And it was not long after 9/11, and that connection felt overdetermined to me. Nevertheless, I felt there was some connection between those two events. Mm. And at the same time as I was thinking about that, well, just watching that documentary, I was also looking at a picture online of an old Roman floor mosaic of a little hare, a glass floor mosaic of a hare about to eat a sprig of clover. And I was thinking about how poignant it was that this poor creature was suspended in a state of permanent hunger and permanent about to munch for the last however thousand years. So the poem really just wanted to put those two thoughts together and see what could be made of them in tandem.
Mm. You're speaking to poets about poetry, formalists and Walt Whitman and others.
Yes.
And the voice of the poet itself today, what is that all about?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I say this thing in it about, here's my problem with America. This would be that obliterates all other moods. So I was striking a kind of mock documentary tone here, I guess, is what I was trying to do. I wasn't wanting to make any real point about formalists or about Whitman. I just was trying to strike some kind of too knowing documentary, maybe sort of PBS documentary tone. One of the big projects of this book is to write about the human, big human event that has unfolded in my life, is which is to have children. And it is a pretty impossible subject. If what you aim for in poetry is a kind of accurate depiction of your emotions, it's very hard to depict unmixed joy, I find. And that's what I feel. And you can't, and I also feel very sentimental about them. And I don't want to write sentimental poems, but to depict accurately what I'm feeling would result actually in sentimental poems. So I was trying to find oblique ways of getting at this issue of what one feels when one looks at one's children. And this little dig at the end, I suppose, is one way of getting the issue of children into a poem without taking it in a direct way or taking it head on.
Mm. Tell us another.
Okay. There are a number of sequences of short poems in this book, and one of them is 10 poems long, but they're short poems.
And beautiful.
Oh, thank you. And it's called Swifts, S-W-I-F-T-S. And I almost never work this way, but it was the case that with this sequence, I was up in the night. It was Thanksgiving 2006, the night of Thanksgiving, in my house. We live in the country. It was really quiet. You can hear animals in the wall and strange shrieks out the window and so on. And I was up in the night, unable to sleep, and I wrote all 10 of these poems in sequence and very rapidly. And I almost never work that way. I usually work very slowly. And I had the experience in writing them of being able, when I was in the middle of writing one, I could imagine the next one and the next one after it. And so the objective in each poem was to get out of that poem as quickly as possible so that I wouldn't forget the one that was to come after or the one that was to come after that. And that became both the principle of working and also the kind of subject of the sequence, this desire in that moment to be as rapid and swift as possible. So I'll read them. The sequence is called Swifts. The first one is called Fist. It is impossible for me to remember the cozy room I slept in as a child. Somebody made my bed up to be paradise. It was hard for me, a hard night when I entered art. The tendons in my wrist are visible. What will I do now I have made this fist? To loosen it feels weird, anticlimactic, a misuse, a misunderstanding of fists. That's how it was with me that night. And so mysteriously I lost my sweetness. Weird to feel intended for violence when what I wanted was an hour of rest. One thing about that first poem is that when you are suddenly feeling that you must write a poem, it's a little bit like feeling that you've made a fist and you're intended for one purpose and one purpose alone. The only way to relieve that tension is to write the poem. But it's quite weird to feel that suddenly your entire language apparatus is this instrument for doing one very specific thing, to punch somebody or what. That was the thinking behind that first poem. Two, Thread. I lack the rigor of a lightning bolt, the weight of an anchor. I am frayed where it would be highly useful, and this I feel perpetually, to make a point. I think if I can concentrate, I might turn sharp. Only I don't know how to concentrate. I know the look of someone concentrating, indistinguishable from nearsightedness. It is hard for the others to be near me, my silly intensity shuffling a zillion insignia of interiority. Being near me never made anyone a needle. I did feel that night, and I do feel when I write poetry, that I'm being used as an instrument for something. And so I wanted these poems to talk back from or narrate the situation of feeling suddenly that you had become instrumental, like a thread, or you'll see later there's a poem called Needle's Eye, like a needle. Three, Wind. find some other reason to sway, Forrest. Old people get bent over from vitamin deficiencies. Trees, take them as your inspiration. For I have neither time nor energy any longer to write poems, to make feeling out of what without me is silent. I find your standing there disgusting. And you, reader, I see you nod your head, tree-like, appraising these lines. I find your standing there not disgusting, but not inspiring either. For tree, all day I wanted to be blown, then someone cut me down. I have instead of thoughts, uses, uses instead of feelings. One day I'll feel the wind again, a moment later I'll be gone. One thing that allowed me to work through this sequence so rapidly and with so much clarity was that I realized I would be working by point and counterpoint, so that if I had a thread poem, I needed to have a needle poem. If I had a cause poem, there was to be an effect poem. If there was a poem about the wind and the trees, I had to represent both sides of that transaction. So things were really speeding up at this point because I had started to develop the points for which I needed counterpoints. Five, cause. Whitman wrote this before he started writing poetry. He was a journalist for years, you know, a radical, a partisan for some ridiculous cause. He wrote this to support, or was it to condemn, a cause. It doesn't matter if you aren't Whitman yet. Now that he's been Whitman for so long, it would. Six, effect. Everything scatters as the night wears on, but you don't scatter, will you? I think we could make this night last forever. With our joined heads, like mathematicians, we could work all night, so that where night once was, work would be. And night, as long as work went on, would never end. It is starting to sound a little tiring, all this working just to stave off morning. Seven, needle's eye. I wish I were as big as a basketball hoop. It is actually painful to be this fine. It is like squinting for no reason, all night, choosing the pain of squinting over going to sleep. And yet, what does it matter how big a target you are? Someone, somewhere, will invent a game to make you hard to hit. Eight, sound, 2 a.m. A minute ago, I was a child coughing, having had too much of everything today except for air. Now I am an animal, feeling, tonight, perplexed. I fled the outside, the cold, the lack of food. I meant to enter a house which I connect with warmth, which my body told me was the appropriate move. Instead, I entered a person's mind. Like the child, I am trapped. I have no will, no life to call my own. Nine, Swifts. It's not exactly true that I wrote all 10 in the same night. This poem, Swifts, I wrote actually a couple days later. And my family and I were at the Harvard Museum of Natural History, and we saw a stuffed swift, the bird swift. And I thought that about got it. This flying thing, which was also taxidermied up on the wall, stood for both sides of the feeling you have when you're writing poetry, one that you're moving and the other that you're, in a way, sort of freezing the world, tracking it in one way, but in another way, actually freezing it. So this poor little creature up on the wall seemed to stand in for the whole process I was writing about in this sequence. Swifts. Reality isn't one point in space. It isn't one moment in time. Look at time, a spool of twine, 1 minute, idle in a sewing kit, the next minute, a shooting star. Reality is an average of moods. Strike that, a flock of birds. Strike that, a single bird tracked through dense forest. You can lose it for hours or days, but it isn't lost. You tired of the metaphor. And the final poem is called Caress. If the first poem, fist is about the making of the fist and the clenching of the mind and language and wanting to embark on writing a poem or a sequence of poems. This is the moment of the fist being unclenched and the hand being available for other uses than punching or fist making, which is what you feel when you're finished with the poem. You suddenly can use language for some other purpose, write an email or greet your wife when she's woken up in the morning, or order your kids around, or whatever other things you have to do with language when you're not inconvenienced by wanting to write poetry. 10. Caress. The tendons flattened and the knot untied. You could do anything then with your hand. You could forget the fact you had a hand. This lasted, or so you were tempted to think, for years. Winter didn't matter, yet spring arrived as a blessing to your body. Sweetness, or what passed for it, returned. And then, like an anchor yanked suddenly from the sea, your muscles clenched.
Hmm. There's so much childhood and boy's eye view.
Yes.
In those brief poems.
Yes.
There are some in which you're the father of your boys. There's others where you're the son of a missing father.
Yes.
Connect all that.
Okay. Well, just to back up, the title of my book is Where's the Moon? There's the Moon. It's actually a quotation from our older son, who's 6 now. He was 2 when I heard him say this.
Did he answer his own question?
Yes. Well, what would happen is he would go around the perimeter of his room at night before he went to bed looking for the moon. And he would say over and over, where's the moon? Where's the moon? Where's the moon? And then we would find it in the sky. He would say, there's the moon, which I thought was great. But it was only the beginning, because at that point, having won the game, essentially, he was disappointed that the game was over. And he had to somehow adapt to this new situation where he had prevailed over this game. So what he would do then is put his hands over his eyes and say, where's the moon? Where's the moon? Where's the moon? And then take them away and say, there's the moon. Mm. When I saw him do that, I knew I had the title of something, a poem or a book or something. It spoke to the human need to have meaning encrypted, to have things be alternately clear and mystified, a kind of hide-and-seek game that we play when we read poetry, that I play when I write poetry. It spoke to the way poetry punctuates time. T.S. Eliot once defined poetry as a means of punctuation, which seems very true to me. They're short, they're bursts, they're immersive, and then they're over. And then you go on to the next one. And this reiterative process of finding and losing and finding and losing and finding and losing just felt to me in some way essential to what I do too when I write poetry. So that was the source of the title.
You make many moon connections with your own papa.
Yeah.
Fill that in.
Yes. I never knew my father. My parents were divorced when I was very young. He lived, I think, much of his life in Korea, where he started another family. He died last fall, which I learned through a third party. So, you know, I grew up really without a father. I had a lot of father figures, but that's not quite the same thing. You have early a very immediate emotional connection to the idea of representation, because all kinds of people are representing the father. And I think in a way that gets you comfortable with the idea that a representation is in some ways a miracle, wonderful to have a representation, but in other ways is a deficiency. All of that, you know, came to bear on watching my own kids as they have grown up.
Do you want to read that poem on page 40, number 3 in the Moon series?
Yes. Sure. Yes, this is a long sequence at the heart of the book. It's called Where's the Moon? There's the Moon. And it's about, well, a lot of things. It's one thing it's about is watching our son, Louis, hold a book and hide, in a way, behind a book. And one of the books that he he can't really read yet. He's just starting to read. But one of the books he would go over and treat as though he was reading it was a book by William Steig called Sylvester and the Magic Pebble, which is an astonishing, sad book about a little boy donkey who goes out for a walk one day and finds this pebble, and the pebble grants him magic powers. He can get whatever he wishes. He is holding it. He sees a lion traipsing across the field. He panics, and he wishes that he were a stone so that he can escape the lion. At the minute he becomes the stone, he drops the pebble, and it's beside him, and the pebble actually has to be in his hand to have any power. So he's then stuck as a boulder in the middle of a field. 80% of the book is the parents looking for the son, asking everywhere throughout the village for the son, grieving for the son. And then at the end, they go for a picnic, and they picnic on this nice-looking boulder in the middle of the field, and they find the nice pebble behind the beside the boulder, and they pick it up, and they say something like, "Oh, I wish our Sylvester were back." And lo and behold, he's back. And then the book ends. The three embrace on the last page. And that's the book that Louis often would pore over at this period of his life. And I would watch him, watching him take himself out of the world and into his imagination reminded me a lot of my childhood, where I would imagine I had a lot of time to myself. I was an only child. I would imagine all kinds of things. And one thing I would try to do is imagine who and where my father was. And that felt a little bit like, because it was so distant, but also so central and so visible, imagining life on the moon. So this section just sort of turns over that idea of the father being both missing, but because he's so centrally missing, very present, having a weird kind of influence upon me, the way that the moon has an influence over the tides and moods. So this is what I say. Section 3. When I picture my father, I see the surface of the moon, planes of moon stuff, chalk dust papers shredded by a paper shredder, snowbanks of shredded paper, nobody to organize it all, no way to, quote, moralize the day out of its aimlessness, nobody with a shop vac handy, slowly to turn the whiteness into pattern and form, revealing, as a chisel reveals in the marble, a figure, a woman's figure, an expression of bliss.
Yeah. Dan Jason, at the end of this book, Where's the Moon? There's the Moon. There are swifter swifts.
Right.
And I wish you'd read a few. I want to hear how they sound in your voice, but I was struck by two that again seem to draw on your boyhood. One called Falls.
Yes.
Bristol, Vermont.
Yeah, thanks. Yes. You know, I grew up in Vermont, very northern Vermont. One thing about writing poetry is the weird way in which place enters in. Setting out to write this sequence of poems, I had no sense that I was deliberately talking about the places of my childhood. And yet they managed to find their way into these poems. A country kid, the way I was a country kid, goes when he gets a car at 16. That's a huge moment in a country kid's life. And one use of a car is to go out and try to find swimming holes. And the best swimming hole I know is in Bristol, Vermont. And this is a little poem, nominally anyway, about that swimming hole. It's called Falls, Bristol, Vermont. The waterfall runs all day and night, shedding big self on the rocks below, refilling with more self, more self, more self, while bathers visit in small groups, never the same bathers, always the same river, my local, inverted, redneck, pre-Socratic. There's this famous thing in Heraclitus about, you know, the pre-Socratic philosopher about never being able to touch the same river twice. And when I wrote about this waterfall, which is up there in Bristol, Vermont, I immediately, that little cliche, almost touchstone of Heraclitus, definitely the only thing I know in Heraclitus, came to mind.
I can give it to you in Greek. Panta rea. All is flux. Everything flows. Isn't that the same
totally
guy?
Stunning. Yes, thank you. Yes, absolutely.
I was struck also by the river sort of emptying itself,
yes.
refilling itself.
Yes.
Self, self, self.
Self, self, self. That's
Emerson, Emerson, Emerson.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I know. Never any way of getting out of the way of oneself, is there? Whatever one does, it feels as though you're just refilling with more self, more self, more self. And Emerson and others would recommend going out, taking a walk, experiencing nature. There's a lot of Thoreau in this book also.
Trust thyself.
Trust thyself. And but this poem, like many poems I write, comes out of a kind of exhaustion with sort of always having to be oneself. Poetry is a way, in a way out of the self you know by heart. You have this field of action. You have associations that are possible. They don't have to be logical. They surprise even the poet. So I guess this feeling of exhaustion with the self, one good way of curing that is to, for me anyway, to write poetry. So
finally, train.
Yes.
Reminded me so much of Thoreau.
Oh, good.
We've been talking about him lately.
Yeah. Yeah, I, you know, for a long time lived in Boston and Cambridge, and then when we had kids, we decided to move out to one of the satellite areas, easily accessible satellite country areas of Boston. And at the time, we were living in an old house. Old New England houses near cities have one big flaw, which is that they're often on very busy roads. So the pastoral ideal that you go and seek out by moving to these places is immediately ruptured by the fact of the passing traffic. And my wife and I are both insomniacs. The only moment in the day that we were free from the unbelievable disruption of traffic was the middle of the night. And because we were on this main road, you could be relatively sure, even if you were trying not to think about it, what time it was. And this poem is about being in an insomniac marriage and also living in this environment of a tiny window in every 24 hours of silence in this, what you intended to be, pastoral retreat. Train. You there in the middle of your mind, curled up into a ball, but wide awake. I am awake like you, in the same bed, hearing the train that when it passes means it's almost morning, though the sky is dark, though the highway is quiet. You can follow the train in your mind, but your mind cannot follow the train from little town to Boston, where in the dark the transactions happen. Something is poured, something is filled, something is dropped off, something is taken. Happen among the loud men at the wharf before their very first sign of dawn, and the train in Boston turns around. I wish our minds were like the train, passing once a night through the woods, fading out among the lights and termini, its load of oil or metal going someplace they want it, returning in the morning, its mile-long belly not empty, not hungry. Not the wharf accepting train after train of junk from the provinces all night, a throat that tries to swallow dirt. I was thinking about the insomniac mind.
I thought of it also as a modern version of Thoreau's train in Walden that
yes.
goes from Boston to Fitchburg, and he wished it away. He said, I can walk to Fitchburg or Boston faster than I can go to one and ride to the other.
Yes, absolutely. And even tried to convince myself that that passing train was the same line train that Thoreau wrote about. And then I later found out that it wasn't. I was very disappointed. But I was aware of having a Thoreauvian experience hearing that train pass. Yeah, yeah.
Dan Chasen, you speak beautifully about where these poems come from in a certain way, but go back to the beginning. What was the poem for you as a little boy that made you think, I gotta do that,
yeah.
or I can do that?
I think poetry and literature in general reached me late. I didn't read a lot as a kid. I seemed to read the same books over and over about the occult, Bigfoot, UFOs, things like that. But I didn't read literature until at least high school, you know, early high school. The point of my adolescence seemed to be to just watch a lot of TV. And I remember watching TV in those days, you flipped among the channels. I remember ending up on PBS, and there was a series on PBS called Voices and Visions, which was
Helen Vendler.
Helen Vendler, who later would become my teacher and mentor and beloved friend, person in my life. Helen Vendler oversaw this whole series, and it was actually, and it holds up today, a wonderful series on eight or so poets, Whitman, Dickinson, Eliot, on up to Bishop, I think is the most recent, Elizabeth Bishop. Anyway, I can remember flipping through channels and coming upon the episode on T.S. Eliot and hearing someone, I don't know whose recording it was, but someone read The Wasteland. And here I was, I hadn't read any literature at all, and suddenly I just thought, well, this poem, The Wasteland, is the most incredible thing I've ever heard. I went out and read it. I didn't understand it. Of course, one doesn't fully understand The Wasteland, and I certainly didn't even close to fully understand it then, but it had some power over me. It felt big in my own minor way. I think it accorded with my sense of my own life as being in tatters, you know. Eliot's sort of always adolescent, you know, that's what's so appealing about him. And it was a great poem for me to read and think about. Somewhat later, I discovered the Love Song of Jailford Prufrock, which was also a great, big, important poem for me. But it all came through this PBS series, which then I watched other episodes. I watched the episode on Robert Lowell, and this would have been my sophomore year of high school. I fell in love with For the Union Dead, the great poem about Boston and race relations in the 60s in America. And all this world was totally foreign to me. I mean, I was not from a highly educated background, and there wasn't a lot of poetry in my house, but those two poets and those two poems were the ones that really hooked me. But they hooked me late. You know, I was already fairly fully formed person by the time I got to poetry.
That's amazing. When did you fill in that vast knowledge that's revealed in all of your criticism?
Thanks. Well, you know, if you decide that you're going to model your life after somebody like Eliot or Lowell, you know, you have a little curriculum for yourself designed. You just have to read everything that Lowell and Eliot read. And so when I got to college, I knew that I had had some Latin from the nuns, but I was very, I just daydreamed the whole time. I didn't pay any attention at all. But when I got to college, I knew I had to have Greek and take some more Latin and build this missing foundation. Both Eliot and Lowell's learning was right on the surface. You know, you could connect the same dots that they connected in a way.
And then when did you take up your own pencil or pen and say, I can do this myself? What, or who was it said you can or you must?
Yeah, I had one magnificent teacher in high school who did all kinds of unorthodox things. Like later in high school, he taught Wallace Stevens to high school kids. It was quite amazing. And he encouraged me. I think I wrote, you know, sort of wasteland-like poems set in my own Vermont adolescence. Attempts to seem demented and damaged like Robert Lowell, though I wasn't. I was pretty well adjusted. so I wrote these kind of high modernist accounts of being 16, and they were probably pretty good imitations. I don't know whether they were good, but I'm sure they weren't good poems, but they might have shown some evidence of a gift. So I was encouraged by a teacher. I then went to college and then graduate school, not intending to be a poet at all, actually really thinking that being a poet and being a critic or scholar, those were exclusive jobs. And if you chose one, you wouldn't necessarily want to do the other. And so spent a long time just kind of boning up on the canon and thinking of myself as a professional critic. And then picked it up again in my mid-20s and picked it up in a big way. You know,
we've asked a lot of poets roughly where was the conversation when you joined it, and what did you want to say?
Yeah,
and who did you want to say it to?
Oh, that's good. Yeah, when I joined the conversation, I think there was a false distinction between poets who wrote out of the self and out of their emotions, who were called confessional or post-confessional. And poets like John Ashbery, who were much more interested in language for its own sake. And the poets that I, when I first started writing, modeled myself after, like Frank Bidart and Louise Glick, that distinction didn't seem to matter much to them. They seemed to be able to do both things. I guess when I first started writing poems and thought of myself as writing a book of poetry, I thought, well, there was still a lot left to do with autobiography. It had been prematurely dismissed. The fancy theoretical thinking was not on the side of writing about your parents or your childhood. And I don't know, I just felt there was enough difference in me from poets that were basically autobiographical that I could add something to that tradition. My first book was quite straightforward autobiographical account of my childhood. And that felt like a polemical thing to do, to write a book with that emphasis, even though you could characterize it or caricature it as an old-fashioned thing to do. It felt sort of like an intervention in the poetry culture to do that. And in a way, everything I've done since, I've wanted to kind of modulate that or moderate that idea to go a little away from just the facts of my life. I mean, I still think of myself as a poet of personal material and of, at some level of abstraction, a confessional writer, but I've wanted to introduce other ways of understanding the self than simply checking the ledger sheet and seeing what was it I did on such and such a date.
The jazz interviewer Arthur Taylor always asks people, do you play for yourself? Do you play for the band?
Yeah.
Do you play for the audience? How about you?
Well, I guess I play for the audience, but the audience in this case is mostly dead. I write for the great poets whose mark is way too high for me to ever reach, but who really made the language that I'm using. And I write to give myself a sense that I'm participating in that ancestry, you know, to feel that weird way of thinking within lyric poetry, this old logic, this old set of symbols. And for myself, I mean, I absolutely hold myself to no other standard than I want to write something that interests me. I wouldn't know how to anticipate what would interest someone else. So how can I write for tastes that I can't even identify?
Ralph Ellison famously and a little contrarily said he preferred the ancestors to the neighbors and the relatives.
Yeah.
Who, when you think of the ancestors, sketch the big names.
And sure.
And you, that great chain of being that,
right,
that comes finally to Dan Chasen.
Okay. Well, first of all, these are all, you know, these are like deities and I'm some kind of plankton. So this is that, so that I wouldn't say that it culminates in me, but if I could write a single poem as good as The Worst Poem by George Herbert, for example, I would be happy. And then, you know, Herbert passing on to, boy, I'm just going to say the usual names, but Blake and Keats, and then the amazing American and gender difference of Dickinson coming in, and the way that her poems kind of recalibrated the idea of intensity and of wit and of thinking. And then it gets interesting where I really feel I am in a conversation is when we get to the 20th century, and that would be Marianne Moore. I find there's something in her mind and sensibility that I can just move around inside, I can learn from, I can take from. The incredible generation of the 1950s and 60s poets, Lowell and Bishop on the one hand, but also the New York School poets, Frank O'Hara, I love, lesser known, but I think equally great, is James Schuyler. And among living poets, I would name John Ashbery, Frank Bidart, Louise Glick, Ray Armantrout. That's the line for me.
If you were reporting to George Herbert, mm-hmm, on his craft, on his trade.
Yes.
Give him a report from 2010. How are we doing?
Oh. Well, when I teach Herbert, my students are spellbound. And these are students who actually are not upper-level seniors or English majors. I teach a class at Wellesley, which is a kind of just pitch for poetry. It's called Great Works of Poetry.
But what would you tell them about the world of your poetry, even the world of your students, what they're getting, what they're producing,
yeah,
what their standards are today?
They, to some extent, all of us, but my students even more keenly, live in this world of texting and world of, I don't know, pulling up four screens at once on their computer, and they're booking flights home, and they're taking notes in my class, and they're calling somebody on some kind of device, and so on. And that's just sort of the way we live. But one thing you could say is that it creates a kind of hunger for intense interiority that poetry does satisfy. And I think, at least I see in my students, that they're so transformed to have an account of interiority that puts aside for the moment all of the technological busyness, and which has become mental busyness.
Dan Chasen, you're in a small category of poets who also are almost better known for your criticism,
yeah,
for these incisive, tough, incredibly learned but funny, swift reviews in The New Yorker. Who's your model for all of that? And what's the balance in your own imagination?
Oh, well, the model would be Randall Jarrell, who I have some quarrels with, but he could be unbelievably funny and vivid in his essays. I don't like his poetry that much, and I hesitate to name him as a model because I think somehow my poetry will be struck down. I would like to be as good as he was at writing essays at both. I think the best poetry critic in my generation is Stephen Burt, and I learn a lot from him. And if he's written something on a poet that I'm going to tackle, I always read what he has to say first.
There are there are others historically, right, including T.S. Eliot.
Yeah.
And Dryden and,
yes,
Samuel Johnson,
right,
and Emerson himself, both a critic and a,
yeah,
poet. But do any of these figure?
They all, I mean, to name them is to feel very tiny in relation to them. But yeah, they, as a model, sure, and Eliot and Robert Lowell, whose criticism is kind of impressionistic, but I think kind of brilliant, very brilliant. When I write criticism, I think I learned late to talk, actually. I was a quiet kid, only child. I felt much more natural writing sentences. And the discipline of writing an essay feels much more like talking to somebody, explaining to somebody something, teaching. And the difference for me between writing poetry and writing criticism feels like the difference between being inside my head and being in a social situation or a social world where I'm actually called upon to be as clear as possible, to be funny, to be engaging, not to lose people's attention. That feels so different from writing poems. I don't know, in some way I still am writing essays to figure out how to talk.
Dan Chasen, will you indulge us in our own version of the Proust questionnaire?
Yes.
What's the talent you'd most love to have that you don't yet?
I would love to be an amazing tennis player. I could take anybody, anytime, anywhere, and beat them.
Woo!
Yeah.
Big ambition.
I'd like to be a great tennis player.
When you think of all the expressive possibilities, including playing baseball or,
yeah,
you know, jumping hurdles, who do you think of as kind of Dan Chasen in somebody else's clothes out there?
Huh. Wow.
Who do you think of your brother, sister, people,
mm-hmm,
doing the work of your spirit, your imagination?
Mm-hmm.
In another way.
There's this guy that I'm friends with, Paul Harding, who's just written Tinkers, this wonderful book.
Don't we love Paul Harding?
Yeah, that's a wonderful book. I would like to have written that book. There's the amazing short story writer, super short story writer, Lydia Davis, whose collected stories was just published, and I just lived, and am still, to some extent, living inside that book. The mind on display there is as extraordinary as any mind I know, you know.
Ray Armantrout's double, and I've got to,
yeah,
read her work.
She's fantastic. And you can see them in dialogue with one another in the work. Yeah, she's wonderful. The French filmmaker Chris Marker's early science fiction movie, Le Jeté, I watched that over and over. It's 28 minutes long, so you can watch it over and over and over and over again. If you don't know it, it's entirely still photography, except for one scene where a woman's eyes open. And something about the arbitrary constraint of making a movie only with still photographs in order to allow for or arrange for this transcendent moment where you actually violate the rules that you've created for yourself, that feels a lot like writing poetry to me.
Mm.
you create a set of arbitrary rules. Even if you're writing free verse, it's a totally rule-bound environment when you write poetry. And in a way, you do it so that that moment where you transcend or transgress those rules will feel so extraordinary. So that's what I love about that. I mean, I would love to compare myself to some athletes. You know, I can remember watching Pedro Martinez during those great seasons, 99, 2000. And it was like watching pure intelligence work itself out in relation to an adversary. It was just astounding, you know, to watch.
It was gorgeous.
Gorgeous. And it was so full of mind. And he was, I don't know, 5'10 or something. I'm 5'10, so I had a sort of identification with him.
And he was frailer than you.
Yeah, yeah, I guess so. Well, he put himself to a few more tests than I have. But he was frail, that's true.
What do you think of as the keynote of your personality as a poet?
Mm-hmm. What I strive for is a kind of athleticism. I want to not have to linger in any thought or emotion or point of view for too long. I like to get from place to place rapidly. I hope to find some kind of intensity, but that allows for within it self-mockery, self-caricature. I guess the keynote would be inner conflict, you know, an inability to decide about and rank language, ways of thinking, ways of feeling.
Do you think of yourself, your work, your writing in a historical context? Where are we now?
Mm-hmm.
When they remember Dan Chasen thriving, writing in 2010, what was he thinking about as the context of all this?
Mm-hmm. I think that all the other remarkable forms of entertainment and forms of diversion that greet us now in this moment put an enormous amount of pressure on poetry. And what I'm doing and what poets that I admire are now doing are figuring out viable accounts of interiority that allow for all the passing mental stuff but don't totally concede the inner life to external buffetings of information and the sense that if you could Google something infinitely, you would know it fully. What I'm doing is trying to figure out ways of keeping some mystery of the self and of language alive.
When the day comes, how do you want to die?
Boy. I'm too superstitious to name a way because I think it'll happen to me when I walk out the door of this bookstore.
Do you have a motto?
I don't have a motto, but I did the other night order some bumper stickers made.
Sounds like a motto to me.
One can do this. Any passing sentiment you have, you can now go online and order some bumper stickers, and lo and behold, they're at your mailbox, you know, 3 days later. So I'll tell you what my bumper sticker
Please.
Was. Okay, ready? We live on a road called Water Row, and I'm always incredibly angry at passing traffic because people drive too fast. So I had a bumper sticker made that says simply, "Go slow on Water Row." That's my motto.
Is there a perfect poem out there in the world?
Yes, many. One would be Sir Walter Raleigh's Three Things There Be. I used to be able to say it all, but I can only probably get a few lines now. Three things there be that flourish on a pace and prosper, though they grow asunder far. But on a day they meet all in one place, and when they meet, they one another mar. And they be these, the wood, the weed, the wag. It goes on from there, but it's a warning to his son. It's about being a good boy so you don't get hung. So that's a perfect poem. And the other perfect poem is Elizabeth Bishop's poem, The Shampoo, which is an amazing love poem, one of the most beautiful love poems I know. The still explosions on the rocks, the lichens grow by spreading gray concentric shocks. They have arranged to meet the rings around the moon, though in our memories they have not changed. And since the heavens will attend as long on us, you've been, dear friend, precipitate and pragmatical. And look what happens, for time is nothing if not amenable. The shooting stars in your black hair, I'm missing some words, but are going where, so straight, so soon. Come, let me wash it in this big tin basin, battered and shiny like the moon.
Very impressive, very beautiful.
Wow.
Dan Chasen, it's a pleasure, and thank you so much for your work, for your commentaries, for this conversation.
My pleasure, Chris. Thank you very much.
Paul McCarthy and Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till listeners add their two bits in comments on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.